Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Bit brisk in our neck of the woods, and while some may have been thinking the temperatures seemed more like what you would be dealing with an Antarctica, it was actually warmer in much of Antarctica than in the Midwest and East yesterday. Readings dipped into the single digits and teens from Boston, New York, and Washington to cities like Atlanta, Nashville, and Birmingham. The coldest weather seen in decades moved into the South and East, with Atlanta seeing a reading of 8 degrees yesterday morning. But a heat wave of sorts starts moving in today when the thermometer in Indianapolis should reach 27 degrees. Other cities in the Midwest could climb above freezing later this week. The cold, a result of a distorted polar vortex. And here to help us understand what that is and talk about other weather phenomenon and weather winter weather patterns is Kevin Klaisel, Associate Dean for Public Service and Outreach in the College of Atmospheric and Geographic Sciences and Associate Professor of Meteorology at the University of Oklahoma, which is where he joins us from this morning. Good morning, Kevin.
Mindy, how are you today?
Great. What's the temperature there?
Oh, it's balmy here. I mean, it's when you're talking about temperatures in the mid-30s over the last couple of days, it's, we've got people running around in shirt sleeves and shorts.
All right, so what is a polar vortex?
Well, the polar vortex is, I wish we had a different name for it, because as soon as you say the word vortex, everybody starts thinking about things like hurricanes and tornadoes. And so when you talk about a vortex, you're talking about something that spins, but this is a really large, slow-spinning air mass that tends to sit on the North Pole over a very, very cold snowpack. And so it's not like a hurricane or a tornado or anything like that. It's a big, bulky chunk of air that's very, very cold. And the reason we call it the polar vortex is because that's where it tends to live. And so when we have long periods of time with snow on the ground, that air just continues to get colder and colder and colder, but that air tends to sit where the snowpack is. Mm. This particular year, because we're seeing changes in the Arctic, that polar vortex has become a little bit more mobile than we have seen in the past. And a little bit like when you put a big pile of butter on top of a pancake, It's slightly skewed to one side, that butter kind of rolls off on one side. That's kind of what the polar vortex has done this week. It's rolled off the North Pole and lodged itself in the central and northeastern part of the United States.
So that's when they're talking about this polar vortex distortion. That's what you're describing here of the melting butter. That's the distortion we're talking about.
That's absolutely true.
So how widespread can this be? I mean, we heard temperatures chilly as far south as Florida. So how far does this travel?
Well, if you look at a globe, the United States is not that large. So when you're thinking about a global mass that can cover the entire pole and some of that slides off, you can easily cover the eastern two-thirds of the U.S. with a portion of the polar vortex. And in this particular case, a fairly large chunk of that air is kind of broken away from its home region. And that's why this is actually pretty short-lived. If you were at the poles, these would be kinds of conditions you would experience for weeks and weeks and weeks on end. You know, here this week, you know, we're talking about only 3 or 4 days where we're going to see those really, really cold temperatures. I was in Boulder just a couple of days ago. It was minus 11, and then 24 hours later, it was 47.
Wow.
it's not as long-lived as you would expect if that polar vortex was still lodged up at the North Pole.
So, but it can last longer, right? I mean, how long can something like that last when it's distorted like that?
Distorted, because we've seen such rapid changes in the jet stream, we're not talking about something that's going to last more than a week or so. And that's pretty normal when something like that breaks off and moves into the central and eastern part of the U.S., that you would see those conditions for 4 or 5 days to a week, and then it would moderate. That might have tickets to a certain football game Saturday night. we're in the middle of January in a playoff game in Foxborough in January. You know, you usually start thinking about things like, oh, snow or cold. But by Saturday night in Foxborough, you're probably talking about 50s and rain.
Wow. We'll take it. So wait, how often do we see this polar vortex distortion? Is it common?
It's not very common. It was far more common before we started, naming it And back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, which is when the polar vortex was actually labeled by the meteorology community, it was happening far more often than it is today.
So predictions for this winter's weather made in November by Weather Services International, part of the weather company, we're calling for cold areas in the northern plains, but warmer than average temperatures in the south, quote, because a strong polar vortex should confine the cold air to the northern latitudes. So I'm guessing this is something that's hard to predict.
Yes. And the way we would look at it is, you know, sort of rooted in this difference between the word weather and the word climate. Climate is like a deck of cards. Weather is the hand that you are dealt from that deck. Mm. And so you might get four twos and a three. You might get, king, ace, queen, jack, ten. And so the individual weather that gets dealt out of that deck of cards is very, very tough to predict. Just like if you were going to Vegas or, mm-hmm. or to a casino or something like that, your ability to predict what's coming out of that deck is based upon what you've seen before. Mm-hmm. And because we haven't seen this instance occur in a fairly long time, sometimes those are a little bit harder to predict.
Right. So then predicting when and if a polar vortex might move south, again, it's difficult. It could or it may stop, short of where we think it might be going.
When a polar vortex breaks off, that it will head southbound into the U.S. It mm-hmm. could conceivably head southbound into Russia or into Europe. And I'll go back to the butter on the pancake. If somebody took one of those, you go to IHOP and somebody puts that big ball of butter on the middle of your pancake, it's tough for you to predict which side of the pancake it's going to roll off of mm-hmm. as it starts to melt.
Yeah, good. That's a good analogy. So does climate change impact this in any way?
It's going to roll off, but the location of where that occurs is really tough to pinpoint. Mm-hmm. Very sensitive.
But what about climate change? Does that impact this?
I would have to be careful to say yes there, because I think I need to qualify that by going back to the deck of cards. I think what we're seeing with the deck of cards is where the old deck of cards may have had the same number of twos and the same number of tens in it. I think our new climate that we're observing has less twos, less threes, and more nines and more tens. Mm-hmm. And what that means is when you are dealt that hand, it doesn't mean you can't get twos.
Right.
But you're more likely to get nines and tens. And so sometimes we're seeing combinations with this new deck of cards that we've never experienced or that are more unlikely to experience. In other words, that new deck of cards, if I replaced a two with a ten, it's conceivable in a hand of five cards that I could get five tens.
Wow. Okay.
Oh, you know, right. That's not what you would have experienced, say, 30 years ago. So one of the things that we're seeing with this brand new deck of cards are new combinations of hands that are dealt that are far more difficult to predict. And that's what, you start to see these articles about anomalies, and all an anomaly is getting a hand of 5-10. That's mm-hmm. not something you would expect.
Right. Well, I haven't given the number out yet, but Joel knows it by heart. 866-999-4626. And Joel is calling from Brewster. Good morning, Joel.
Hi, I have a two-parter. Is the Arctic vortex and the jet stream instrumental in affecting each other? They both go counterclockwise, and the jet stream seems to be some kind of border between the polar air and the prevailing westerlies. I was just wondering if that is the case. And in the Northern Hemisphere, we have these classifications that from the jet stream to the prevailing westerlies to the Tropic of Cancer and the northeast trades, or first off the horse latitudes and the northeast trades, then the doldrums, and then the southeast trades, and then the prevailing westerlies and the roaring 40s, but we never hear anything about the Antarctica. Do they have a vortex around there, and is there a southern hemisphere jet stream?
Okay. Go ahead, Kevin.
Joel is a meteorologist. Right?
No, he's not, but he's a very smart guy.
The answer, I think, across the board is yes. That polar vortex that occurs, it occurs over both poles. So you have a polar vortex in the southern hemisphere over Antarctica, and you have one in the northern hemisphere. The thing you have to remember is that while we are in winter in the northern hemisphere, you're in summer in the southern hemisphere. And I think it was mentioned even in the lead-in to this that the temperatures were actually warmer in the Antarctic than they were in Indianapolis or somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that is because they are in their summer hemisphere. You know, they're in summer right now. But yes, in the wintertime, you would have a very strong polar vortex over Antarctica. And the other things about the jet is a boundary. It is very much those high winds serve as the wall or the demarcation point between very cold air to the north and very warm air to the south. In a typical year when the polar vortex is kind of lodged at the North Pole, the jet stream is much farther north. Mm. But when you have a piece that breaks off like it did this week, then the jet stream moves much farther south. This is extremely important in things like aviation, because if you're traveling from west to east, you get there much more quickly. But if you are traveling from east to west, it's much more difficult because of the headwind. Mm-hmm. And so what you wind up with are disruptions in air travel schedules because the wind patterns have changed so much.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you talk about that jet stream. I used to live in Nashville, Tennessee, and, you know, the weather could be very different depending on where that jet stream was going.
Oh, yes. And we look at that in the spring as well. The jet stream is instrumental in where severe weather is located. And this is kind of something that we're looking at for, you know, we're already into January and our spring severe weather season is right around the corner. And with a jet stream much farther south, you start to think about the risk of severe weather in places like Florida and the southeast U.S. And we tend to get those larger severe weather outbreaks in the south and southeast when the jet stream is much farther south.
All right, Jill, thanks for the call. Now, we've had very cold temperatures, but then it warms up again relatively quickly. So what causes some cold snaps to linger while others are short-lived?
In many instances, it has everything to do with the underlying surface conditions. Especially in the summertime, I think everybody can relate to walking barefoot across pavement or across a sidewalk. Mm-hmm. You do not want to spend much time on that pavement. You want to get to the cooler as fast as you can. Air will take on the characteristics of what is underneath it. So if you have a very large snowpack, then that air is going to remain much colder, much longer than if that air was over a chunk of land that did not have a snowpack and was more regulated by the sun. The other thing that snow will do is it will reflect sunlight, so it's harder to warm up. So in many instances, this particular cold snap lasted as long as it did because of the huge snowpack over Canada and over the northern part of the U.S.
Mm. We're talking with Clevin Klazel, Associate Dean for Public Service and Outreach in the College of Atmospheric and Geographic Sciences. He's an Assistant Professor of Meteorology at the University of Oklahoma. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeendislands.org. Last week, you probably heard us talking about freezing fog. We're going to find out what it is right after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking weather with Clevin Klazel, who's the Associate Professor of Meteorology at the University of Oklahoma. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you have a weather question for us or you want a weather story, perhaps. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeendislands.org. All right, Kevin, last week during our snowstorm, we were hearing about freezing fog. And I have to say, I never heard of it before. I was a ski reporter years ago, and I thought, fog eats snow. How could it be freezing fog? And I afterwards we had a lot of people saying to me, what was freezing? What is that? What is free? So I guess we don't get that a lot around here, so it seems kind of odd to our ears. So what is freezing fog?
We'll point a little bit at the meteorology community. I think we have as many names for different things. We try to be descriptive in terms of how things form, and of course fog, for a commuter or you know, mariner, something like that, fog is fog.
Right.
You know, it's a hazard. But when you have that fog combined with temperatures below 32 Fahrenheit, you have the capability where those little tiny water droplets that are in the atmosphere will freeze onto surfaces. This is not really any different than when you have that fog build up in your bathroom. Mm. When it builds up in the bathroom, it tends to stick to things. So the wall, the mirror, the towel rack, you know, those are the things that get wet. Well, if you could somehow turn the temperature down to below freezing in your bathroom, what you would wind up getting is water droplets in the atmosphere, but when it adheres or sticks to something, it would freeze on contact. So freezing fog is nothing but a regular fog, but freezes because of the cold temperatures onto things like windshields and cars and those kinds of things. It makes travel very difficult because sometimes that freezing fog can actually stick your windshield wipers to the windshield and make it very, you know, difficult to get the water or that ice off your windshield when you're driving.
So is there a difference then between freezing fog and ice fog?
Yes, there is, because ice fog, those little tiny water drops tend to freeze in the atmosphere before they adhere to something. Oh. So you wind up with sort of these ice crystals that are in the atmosphere first, and then they sort of deposit onto things. Freezing fog's a little bit more dangerous because you've got these obstructions to visibility, which are the water droplets, and then they're freezing onto things like your windshield.
So we don't see it that often. Was it because it got so cold after the snow here? Why would we see freezing fog here? Is it normally a West Coast thing?
Oh, it's actually pretty prevalent in places like the Central Plains and places where you have significant amounts of moisture. One of the things that we're seeing with these storms over the past, decade or so, is that there is an observed increase in the amount of water in our atmosphere, and that's globally. And because of that increase in the amount of water in the atmosphere, more evaporation off of warmer oceans, we're starting to see those situations where you have more water in the atmosphere, and then that creates those fog conditions. When you combine them with the cold temperatures, like over a snowpack, then you start getting freezing fog. So it's counterintuitive, I know, and from our perspective all the time, it's very difficult to say, wow, the warmer atmosphere is causing the freezing fog. You know, warmer and freezing don't go well together in our brains in that sentence, but that's actually the cause.
Yeah. Well, we had a great link to a NOAA website that had all these different fog descriptions and photos, and we'll put that back up on our website for folks who are interested in seeing all the different types of fog that are out there. Who knew, right? Who knew there were all these different types of fog?
Things that you'll see is we get very descriptive with respect to the fog against how it forms. So most of the descriptive terminology on those fogs is nothing but an identifier for us to help us explain how that fog got there in the first place.
All right. So this last snow, the forecast called for a chance of thunder showers. So what's going on meteorologically to have snow and thunderstorms?
Well, to have thunderstorms, you need to have strong upward air currents, and you also need a lot of moisture. So this gets back to exactly what I was talking about before, the increase in the amount of moisture in the atmosphere. When that water condenses, it actually warms the atmosphere, which creates that warm air rising. And when you have warm air rising, warm is a relative term. It's the air in that upward current against the air around it. And so when I say warm, a lot of people in their head are thinking, oh, 70s, 80s, or something like that. That's not the case. We're talking about warm relative to the air around it, which creates the upward air current. In this particular case, the warming associated with condensation of all of that excess moisture is causing localized areas where warm air currents relative to the air around it go up, and you create thunderstorms. These thunderstorms just happen to be, though, at temperatures that are below freezing, and so you wind up with what is called thunder snow.
Thunder snow, right. So can it rain at temperatures below 32, or does it automatically turn to snow?
No, water is really unique in that even though it melts at 32 Fahrenheit, it doesn't necessarily freeze at 32 Fahrenheit. The 32 Fahrenheit is the number for pure water, and very rarely do we ever see pure water. This also gets into why snowflakes are all different. And, you know, all of these, you know, some of the snow is very wet. Some of the snow is more powdery. none of those water drops are pure. They're all condensing onto something. It might be salt. It might be dust. It might be pollen. And so you get very, very different situations where, like in a freezing fog case, that is liquid water that is existing at temperatures below what we would call freezing, and then it freezes onto something. Water needs a place to freeze onto, and whether that's a windshield or a mirror or something like that, water can exist in what is called a super-cooled state, and that is water that exists as a liquid below 32 Fahrenheit.
So those snowflake crystals, the shape depends on the temperature then at which it's formed and the moisture that's in there.
Absolutely correct.
Yeah. All right, so is it ever too cold to snow?
You would have to get really, really cold to the point where there is not enough water vapor available for snow. So, yes, there are temperatures where it is too cold to snow.
See? Who knew? So at our latitude in North America, weather moves from west to east. But on the East Coast, we can also be influenced by weather moving up from the south. So does that put the East Coast in the crosshairs for more weather events?
Wow, that's the million-dollar question. And that's the question that was being asked after Sandy. Wow, are we going to see more of these? And, you know, it gets back again to the deck of cards. It's how that hand is dealt. And that's, you know, are we seeing more and more of these types of extremes? The unfortunate answer is yes. Mm-hmm. We're seeing, you know, now does that mean I'm saying there's going to be another Sandy next year? No, because I don't know what the hand is going to look like that gets dealt. But as we get, you know, more and more warmth in the Gulf Stream and cold air over snowpacks because we have more moisture in the atmosphere because it's a warmer atmosphere, then, yes, we will see more and more of these anomalies where it's sort of the notion of an average is becoming more meaningless. And we'll be dealing with these extremes.
Yeah, we're talking with Kevin Klazel. He's an associate professor of meteorology at the University of Oklahoma. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join our conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So you often hear people say that if the snowflakes are big, we won't get much, but if they're small, we'll get a lot more snow. Is there any science behind that?
There's some truth to that because of the geometry and because of the weight. The bigger snowflakes weigh more, and so they tend to compress and compact as they fall. So it's like if you walked on it. You know, if you take snow and you walk on it, you can take a 6-inch snowfall and turn it into a 2-inch snowfall immediately by putting your foot on it.
Hmm.
So if you have heavier snowflakes, that weight will compress that snow, where the lighter, smaller will have more air space between the snow, and you end up with actually a larger accumulation simply because of the air spaces between those smaller flakes.
That's interesting. So with the advances in technology and the internet, many of us referring to the regional radar to see if precipitation is coming, but it can be difficult to distinguish between snow, drizzle, and rain. So why is that?
And the million-dollar question, the...
I had two. That's $2 million questions today.
50,000 visitors, and I think half of them are third graders. And if I say the word snow to a third grader, especially down south, they're not going to say white, they're not going to say cold, they're not going to say flake. Their word association with the word snow is no school. Only every time we have blown a snow versus rain forecast because they had this anticipation that they weren't going to go to school. So what happens is a radar that's looking up into the atmosphere, because of the Earth's curvature, the radar beam is actually pretty high up. And everything that happens with respect to rain versus snow is occurring down near the ground.
Mm.
And so our radars may be detecting snow at the higher elevations, but not detecting the fact that it's melting before it hits the ground. So we have a problem here in the U.S. with the way we use radar that makes it very, very difficult to get that rain versus snow forecast correct. Now, we've changed our radars recently, adding something called dual polarization. And dual polarization allows us to use a radar to better determine whether it's a water drop or a snowflake. Mm. But that still doesn't change the fact that we don't sense the near ground atmosphere as well as we could.
You said the way we use radar in the U.S., do we use it differently than the rest of the world?
Yes. We have different paradigms. And even within the U.S., for example, the broadcast community, our TV broadcasters will utilize radar in different ways than, say, the National Weather Service uses it. And what I mean by that is that radar works like a flashlight. So if you were to take a flashlight in your room and you would spin around in a circle, your light is only going to illuminate the spot on the wall that you're pointing at. Now, the atmosphere is three-dimensional. So if I stay at the same level and scan and scan and scan, I'm only scanning at that one level. The atmosphere is three-dimensional, which means I need to scan above me as well. So the National Weather Service uses a scanning strategy that tilts that radar up through the atmosphere, and that's why it takes about 6 minutes for that radar to scan the entirety of the atmosphere. A broadcaster, on the other hand, may keep that radar tuned at the lowest elevation and continue to scan that lowest elevation, and that's why sometimes you hear broadcasters say, hey, we can scan the atmosphere much more quickly than the Weather Service can. And that's simply because of the way that they're using their radar.
Right.
The meteorologist at the Weather Service needs to know the three-dimensional structure of the whole atmosphere. And so we are going to use the radar to scan the entirety. Because remember, the jet stream is up at 30,000 feet. It's not down near the ground. For us to know from a forecast perspective what's going to happen next, we need that entire picture.
Yeah, so this is why you can have meteorologists using the same tools coming up with different forecasts then.
Absolutely true.
Yeah. All right, so but certainly we've come a long way in those tools and the science of weather gathering.
We're making advances faster than we can keep up. And I'm guessing that, and I'll go back to the football analogy, one of the reasons for Tom Brady's success is because he's got a good offensive line, and the offensive line gives Tom Brady a chance to have time to make a decision. In the weather vernacular, that six-minute radar update that I was just talking about, we have 6 minutes to make a decision before we get a new scan of the entire atmosphere. We are changing radar technology, though, in such a way that we're going to be able to scan on time frames that are less than 30 seconds, less than 10 seconds. And so when you take a forecaster who's used to having 6 minutes to make a decision, and now you give them 10 seconds to make a decision, it's a little bit like saying, hey, Tom, we're going to try this play without an offensive line, and I need you to make a split decision, find your receiver, and make sure you don't throw an interception. And so our forecasters are kind of being put into that position where they're going to have to make decisions much more quickly, much more rapidly, much more efficiently with the new radar technology. So in this case, the technology is kind of outpacing our ability to use that technology well. So we have a lot of work to do on the education side.
So this leads into your research. Talk about how the public perceives weather and uses weather and climate info to make decisions.
I think people are now using weather and climate information in ways that they weren't aware. And being in an academic role here at the University of Oklahoma, at the beginning of a semester, it's always fun to visit with the parents and the new students that come in at orientation. And I get the question all the time, okay, well, what can my son or daughter, what can they do with that meteorology degree? Because most people are familiar with the Weather Service. Most people are familiar with television broadcasting. But it's so much more than that. And I'll usually say, well, gosh, they could go work at Walmart. And you see this look that sort of falls across the faces of everybody, and they're like, oh, my gosh, is it that bad? You know. But you think about Walmart. When you walk into Walmart and it's snowing outside, the first thing you see are things like snow shovels, de-icer, mittens, you know, all of those things that weren't there 3 days before when it wasn't snowing. We are seeing differences in the way we shop. So when my parents used to shop for things, they would go to a favorite store. The favorite store didn't have the item. They'd go home, and they'd go back another time. Now, if Walmart doesn't have your item, you go to Target. If Home Depot doesn't have it, you go to Lowe's. You get that item before you go home. So most of the commerce in our country is becoming more sensitive to weather and just-in-time delivery to provide those things that you need, because the floor space for these particular vendors are not warehouse space anymore. Those are at huge, large distribution centers. So, for example, over Christmas, all of the packaging problems that Amazon had and UPS and all of those delivery problems, those were mostly weather-related. Mm-hmm. And so you see more and more of the transportation companies using weather expertise, hiring meteorologists. So weather and climate now is about one-third of our gross domestic product in terms of its impact in this country. Mm.
I was looking up some weather facts, and I found this one. I have to read it. It says, you may have heard someone say it's raining cats and dogs. There have been actual documented cases from around the world of fish, frogs, dead birds, snakes, snails, beetles, worms, and jellyfish raining down from the sky in great numbers, but no reports of showers of cats and dogs. But even some of this other stuff, raining frogs and jellyfish, that seems kind of odd.
Just the first book they see is it's raining frogs and fishes. And it's all these stories of, you know, various things falling from the sky for various reasons. And no, we've never observed cats and dogs.
So looking at the winter weather pattern, I'm asking you to put on the forecasting hat now. Can we really say what the rest of the winter will be like?
You know, part of this is when you see things that you are familiar with, they become much easier to forecast. I've got two kids. I can tell you what my son's going to do before it even happens. I cannot do that with my daughter. and so there are certain types of patterns in the atmosphere that are extremely predictable. And there are others when you get like really wavy jets, et cetera, where they are very difficult to forecast what happens. We are in one of those situations that's a little bit more like my daughter. It's a little bit more of the unpredictable, wavy type of patterns that makes it really difficult on a meteorologist.
Right. Kevin Klaisel is Associate Dean for Public Service and Outreach in the College of Atmospheric and Geographic Sciences and Associate Professor of Meteorology at the University of Oklahoma, which is where he joined us from this morning. Kevin, thanks so much for being with us and filling us in on the weather lingo. We appreciate your time this morning.
Guys, stay warm, and if you go into a football game Saturday night, take a poncho.
And an umbrella, maybe. All right, up next, picture history books on the town of Barnstable. The town of Barnstable was established in the early 1600s, and over time, seven distinct villages were established: Barnstable, Centerville, Catuit, Hyannis, Marston's Mills, Osterville, and West Barnstable. Joining us to talk about two new picture history books of the towns, Stephen Robert Lovell Farrar, author of Images of America, Barnstable, and James Gould, co-author with Vivian Cushing of Images of America, Marston's Mills. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And Stephen, your book on the town of Barnstable focuses on a specific time period, the decline of the maritime industry and the beginning of the tourist economy. So explain why you chose this time period and where your images come from.
Well, when we were first contacted to do the book by Arcadia Press, they asked us to do a book on local Barnstable history. And when we surveyed our picture collection at the Barnstable Historical Society, we found that really, our picture collection sort of went from 1839 to 1939, and which was between two anniversary celebrations. So that's where we started off mm-hmm. with it.
And the pictures came from then this?
Mostly the Barnstable Historical Society, mm-hmm. as well as one or two of its members, okay. and from my own collection as well.
Okay. So. And then, Jim, the Marston's Mills book spans a greater time period. One of the earliest images you include was an 1865 map of the village, and then later pictures are from cranberry harvests in the 1960s. So what determined the scope of your book?
Well, no book had ever been written about Marston's Mills, so this is the first time. So we were able to cover the whole history of Marston's Mills, which goes back to the 17th century. And we fortunately had a wonderful photographic collection that had been put together by the Historical Society 35 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And had never been published. There were calendars and little cards put out at one time. But this whole collection was the first time most of these photos yeah. had ever been seen.
That's amazing almost every town has had one of these books. It's amazing that this is the first one.
But the photos disappeared at one point.
Uh-oh.
They got digitized. And the president had them all digitized. And then he was bitten by a bat.
Oh,
and
no.
Died of rabies and didn't give his wife the password to his collection.
Oh,
so we
no.
were unable to go to, so we had to go back to the original photos. This is sort of an exciting search for these photos.
Wow, it's a little
every
detective
archivist's
work.
Nightmare, I
yeah,
think.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're there, but I can't get them. So Marston's Mills was mainly farming country. And, Jimmy, you have some wonderful images of the ponds and the grist mills and the cows from Hoard's Mystic Lakes Dairy. The picture really gives you a sense of how rural it was.
And it still is probably the most rural of all of the villages. Maybe West Barnstable comes close, but there's a lot of open space. There are big lakes, and there are woodlands and big fields and a grass airfield. So it's probably the most Cape Cod like village of all of the, maybe on the whole Cape.
I think everybody wants to think theirs is like the most Cape Cod-y, right? So even though Marston's Mills was mainly an agricultural town, you write that many of the young men from the village did go off to sea, and William Wright and Seth Weeks might have one of the more unusual sea stories.
Oh, they were in Melville's story. They were two of the sailors that signed up in New Bedford to go on the Essex, which was the ship that Moby Dick is based on.
Right.
And they were actually ran by a whale twice. And after it sank, they got moored on a desert island in the middle of the Pacific, thousands of miles from any place at all. And they were left there by their companions, who decided to go to Chile. And most of them never made it because they ate each other.
Right, I remember that story, yeah.
So these two Marston's Mills boys and a third man, the mate, were able to escape that fate. Fortunately, they were picked up before they starved to death, but they lived on gulls' eggs
and birds'
eggs and
whatever they could find
on this desert island.
Stephen, as tourism begins to grow, so do the number of inns and resorts that are built. And you have some wonderful photographs of both the early small lodges and then the stately large resorts, such as the Hallett House and the Wiano Club. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's was kind of an interesting evolution. Tourism started around the 1870s in earnest in the town of Barnstable. And a lot of it was first based in old sea captains' houses, sort of like, you know, large houses. A lot of these people would take in summer visitors for the extra income that it would bring, or they would involve themselves in the tourist trade one way or another by providing meals or by providing carriage services, that type of things. A lot of the old inns that were built were actually constructed around old sea captains' houses. So, for example, the Hallett House was a smaller house and then was built up to a huge size, built out, exactly, and whatnot. And then these resorts, if you'd like to call them that, attracted the same crowd year after year of devoted people that would come and love to stay at the same place they'd been at the year before.
Yeah, and some of those resorts were really grand. I mean, you see lots of old postcards. Most of them are gone now, those big, huge resorts that they had.
As somebody who pointed out in my book, they had a tendency to burn down, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So a lot of them, and even the Wiano Club, which was known as the Cotacheset House, had a devastating fire and burned to the ground. The owners there rebuilt very quickly, and I think it was back in service by the next year, but as a totally different building.
Yeah. So in the collection that you use for the photographs, were some of them, I know a lot of people collect the old postcards. Is that part of what your collection is?
Some of them are old postcards and some of them are old pictures as well. A lot of our collection are family albums that came to the Barnstable Historical Society, and a lot of them, were postcards. Mm-hmm. And it was a great way of preserving images of what the old areas looked like.
Yeah, when you think about that, how many people have boxes of photographs up in their attic or stuck in a closet somewhere, and maybe so far back you don't even remember who these people are? What a great idea to leave them to a historical
society. Tons of people have albums like that all over the town of Barnstable. And as I like to tell people, make sure you write some information on the back of those pictures so we know exactly what area the house is in, who the people are in the picture. A lot of times we would get an album, we had no idea whether it was town of Barnstable or the people were connected with the villages one way or another.
Don't you have to be careful, though, what you write in? Can't that damage the photo? I mean,
yeah, you have to use a special archival pen to write on the back of the photo so that it doesn't leave an indentation on the other side. Absolutely.
All right, something to keep in mind there. All right, so both of your books have images from the early Barnstable County Fair. Now the fair, of course, is in the town of Falmouth, but it started in Barnstable, and the early images of the fair really show, in many respects, similar to the modern-day fair, isn't it?
Absolutely. You don't have quite the number of mechanical rides as you have these days, but the essential, I'd say, plan of the fair is the same. You have horse races. I don't think they do baseball games at the modern fair anymore. But you had a midway, which back in the late 19th century, early 20th century, was called Faker Row, where you had novelties, snake oil salesmen, fortune tellers, that type of thing.
Yeah. And then, of course, we always have had the, judging the agriculture and the flowers and things like that.
Oh, we have a picture of a horse drag where they put as much weight as possible on a barge and then get horses to drag this. And this is one of the great rural contests that went on all the way up into the 1930s.
Yeah.
And I think as a child going to the Barnstable County Fair, when it was located in Marston's Mills, back in the 60s, they were still doing that same kind of horse dragging where they put the weights on and see how far the horses could drag the sledge with the weight.
But we had aerial stunts. These small biplanes come in, and people would jump out of them and parachute out. This was a added feature of the rural fair.
Yeah. Great fun.
Well, you mentioned, Jim, the first airfield on Cape Cod was in Marston's Mills in an old potato field. And that airfield, of course, is still there today. The Marston's Mill book has some really wonderful images of the early plains.
Yes, we had the proprietor of the airport, the fellow who runs it today, has a wonderful photo collection of old plains gave us the permission to reproduce these, but there's some wonderful. It's a grass runway, and this is the they've kept it this way. It belongs to the town of Barnstable today, and we've kept it that way and still. But a lot of famous people have landed at that airport. Amelia Earhart, we have a woman in Marston's Mills who remembers shaking hands with her.
Wow. And then, Stephen, you mentioned that many of the images in the Barnstable book come from the Thatcher family. And off-air, and you mentioned that two of your favorite images in the book are of Franklin Thatcher, a Civil War veteran. So describe these images and why you found them so meaningful.
Well, they were very meaningful because Franklin Thatcher was a facet of, like, Memorial Day parades, 4th of July parades, Labor Day parades, and he would don his old Grand Army of the Republic uniform, get on his horse, and lead the parade and whatnot. And so that was one interesting feature. The other one was a Memorial Day and Welcome Home Day parade for returning veterans. And one of the photos in the book, which is that one right there you're looking at, of course the audience can't see it, but shows the surviving Barnstable Civil War veterans on one side of the street with troops on the other side, and I believe that's the one where they're unveiling the flag with the 65 stars and whatnot.
I kind of like this Girl Scouts Welcome Home Parade 1919.
Yeah. And they all have like letters on their shirts and stuff spelling out welcome.
So Cape Cod, known for its salt water, but the freshwater ponds played a large role in the history of our region. And both of your books make a point to illustrate this. And Jim, talk about this, the illustration, the photos you have of freshwater ponds.
Well, there are three large ponds, the second largest in the town of Barnstable, Mystic Lake. And these feed into a herring run, one of the best herring runs on Cape Cod. And it's still running herring, but they used to get thousands of barrels of herring, which were then pickled and then shipped all over the United States from that herring run. So this is the basis of the Indian settlement, which was the founding of Marston's Mills. But then it was followed, when it was dammed up, the river was dammed up, coming down from the lakes, were able to use the water power for basically the first industry in the United States. Mm-hmm. Some of the first industries were iron industries, but the fulling industry was the most important. That hence Marston's Mills. It's the fulling mill was the basis of a large industry in the village. They wove cloth and made battens and all kinds of other things from this mill that was doing the fulling.
Hmm. And what about your ponds?
Well, in the book Barnstable, I focused on Wequocket Lake quite a bit. And Wequocket Lake was once known as Nine Mile Pond. And the name was changed during a boat race celebration in the late 1800s when they changed it from Nine Mile to Wequocket. And it had a number of different resorts on it. Chief among them was Campo Peachy, and Campo Peachy is now the Wequocket Yacht Club, I believe.
Because who wants to have a yacht club on a pond, right?
Well, and it's a pretty big pond. But back in the 19th century, it was very popular for boating. They had a number of steamers that operated for tourism purposes on the lake. People would come and fish. I think I pointed out in the book that a impossibly huge carp was actually caught by one of the fishermen there, a German carp. They figured it must have been introduced at some point along the way, but it was quite large. And there were a number of other houses and inns on the lakes as well. There were cafes, and it was quite an active waterfront, probably much more than it is now, I would assume.
So talk a little bit about the research. I mean, you know, you have all of these photographs, and some of them you have a lot of information on, some not so much. You obviously both know a lot about history of the towns because you do that. So tell me about what kind of research. Were you just picking your own brains, or did you have to do other research?
What we did was we had to go with the photographs that we were fairly sure of the information on, and that was the basic information that was on the back of the photograph. Some of them had very little detail. Some of them had a lot of detail. There was one photograph specifically in there that named a person, named the area, named the train, and all that type of stuff, which was great. Some of it depended on personal recollections. I selected the photos with two of the other curators for the Barnstable Historical Society, Robert Stewart and Lisa Blair, and I depended on their historical knowledge quite a bit.
So
you've
used all your heads there.
I
remember this.
Yeah.
What about you, Jim?
I ought to give credit to my co-author, Vivian Cushing, who is a lifelong resident of Marston's Mills. Her husband was actually the historian. He had died, but she had accumulated all this information. So she's the one who I depended on
for
the facts. We did a little bit of original research by talking to the old timers. For instance, Charles Hamblin, who was in his 93 or so, and a very sharp memory, one of the Jones family. Mrs. Childs is in her, she's 90, 90, 91, I guess.
Got to get some oral histories to these folks.
Fun to talk to these people about their recollections.
Absolutely.
Well, and one of the things that I just want to interject that we use as a research tool was the Barnstable Patriot, which had been digitized and placed online. And fortunately, the dates for that was from 1830 to 1930, which fell in line with our own parameters for the book.
All right. Stephen Robert Lovell Farrar, his book is Images of America, Barnstable, and James Gould, author of Images of America, Marston's Mills. Thank you both.
Thank you very much. It's
Thank
been
you.
A pleasure.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vince produces The Point with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.